In one of his most famous speeches, the American civil rights leader Martin Luther said, "I have a dream." And I don't think he was sleeping one night, he dreamt a literal dream. It was just a metaphor for his vision of a future time when the racial problems that then existed in America, maybe still exist today, would be a thing of the past. Well, today we're going to look at the life of someone who really did have a dream, a literal dream that was given to him by God, which in due course came to pass. And that person, as we've already heard, is the biblical patriarch Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. We've already heard that in the Bible reading. Now, unusually, the story of Joseph is not only one which is pretty familiar to most Christians, it's also familiar to quite a few non-Christians. I recall Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical from a few years back called Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now, you couldn't have put on a musical like that if there wasn't a lot of familiarity among the general population, even among people who've never been to church, about the coat of many colours. I'm sure we've all heard that. And the musical was quite popular, and I think it even got made into a film. It also tells us that Joseph's life also tells us something which may be a bit disconcerting, which is we tend to think of dysfunctional families as being a problem that's unique to modern life. But I think we're going to see that Joseph's family shows us otherwise. You know, people have always been the same, with relationships damaged and complicated by sin. And Joseph was born into a family whose complications were even worse than most families today. And we're going to see that Joseph himself was affected by that. Now, one of the characteristics of the Bible that in fact testifies to its truthfulness is that it does not idealise its heroes. We get to hear about their faults as well as their virtues. And that's not a great surprise, because these people were just like us, and nobody in the Bible is perfect other than Jesus Christ. No human being is completely flawless and without sin. Every single person that the Bible mentions, apart from Jesus, needed a saviour. And I think we need to remember that. It really doesn't matter who they were. Now, I say this at the start of the sermon because I think some Bible commentators have an unfortunate tendency to over-idealise Joseph. They present him as someone who's virtually flawless and without sin. And of course, to us, as very much flawed individuals ourselves, that is not a very helpful approach. Because when we consider what lessons we can learn from Joseph's life, we need to be realistic in the way we approach it. So if in this sermon I appear to be dwelling a little bit too much on Joseph's defects, it's only that I'm trying to be as realistic as possible and seeing how we can apply this information to ourselves as flawed human beings. Because the Bible doesn't tell us these things to damage anyone's reputation. It's to teach us as Christians how to live better and avoid some of the pitfalls in life that can affect us. And in addition, and I think a very important point, to reassure us that God does not need us to be totally perfect in order to fulfil his purposes for us. Even when we sin, or in some way get things wrong, we can take comfort from the fact that God can take even our mistakes, even our shortcomings, and use them for his ultimate purpose. Now, the Bible does give us a lot of information about Joseph and his family, and there's far too much actually for me to recount it in the space of a single sermon. So what I'm going to do today is mostly focus on his early life to see what we can learn from it. And I'm sure as the story is very familiar, you'll be able to remember most of the rest anyway. Well, let's start with Joseph's family. Joseph's father, Jacob, had two wives and two concubines, or subsidiary wives. Joseph's real mother, Rachel, had died some years previously when Joseph was still very young, while giving birth to his only real full brother, whose name was Benjamin. Now, rather unwisely, and I'm sure you know the background to the story, Jacob had favoured Rachel, above his other wives. And her son, Joseph, inherited that favour. But following Rachel's death, Joseph's remaining family consisted of his father, Jacob, his stepmother, who was called Leah, Jacob's two concubines or secondary wives, and no less than three sets of half-brothers. And inevitably, they were not a very cohesive family group. They never are. You can see this in the later kings of Israel, actually. You have lots of half-brothers, they don't get along very well. By Genesis 37, when we get to Genesis 37, we can see that Joseph was by now 17 years of age, so he's still a teenager. And Jacob is continuing to show favoritism towards Joseph because he was the firstborn son of Rachel. And this favoritism had a very adverse effect on the whole family. So we're going to start the reading. You've already heard this, but I'll read it out again. This is verse 2. Genesis 37, verse 2. I'm starting from the NIV. I'll tell you when I go over to a different translation, but this is the NIV. Genesis 37, verse 2. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Well, those were the two subsidiary wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. After that, Jacob gives Joseph a multicoloured tunic, the coat of many colours. Now, some Bible translations describe it as a coat with long sleeves. But either way, I think both descriptions are valid. It would have been a very expensive, multicoloured garment with long sleeves, yes. The point about it, it was a badge of honour, normally reserved for the firstborn son. But actually, Joseph was not Jacob's firstborn son. He was actually son number 11 out of 12. So he's very nearly actually the youngest. The actual firstborn son of Jacob was Reuben. But of course, Jacob favours Joseph and treats him as though he was the firstborn, even though he's actually only son number 11. And under the surface, that sends a terrible message to the rest of the brothers. Jacob gives them the impression that compared to Joseph, they're just second-class citizens. He neither loves them nor honours them as much as he done Joseph. It's also, unfortunately, obvious that this encourages Joseph to have a pretty high opinion of himself, which sometimes manifests itself into an equally low opinion of others, like his other brothers. And as we saw in verse 2, Joseph brings a bad report of his brothers to his father. I mean, he's 17 now, isn't he? So he thinks he's entitled to do it. To make things even worse, Joseph then has a dream. In fact, he has two dreams. Verse 5. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." And his brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Are you going to actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. They already didn't like him very much. Verse 9. He had another dream and told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What's this dream you had? When your mother and I and your brothers actually come down and bow down to the ground before you?" Now, it's not unknown in the Bible for God to speak to people via dreams. You occasionally hear about it even today. But who was the dream addressed to? It was addressed to Joseph. It wasn't a dream given to his father or his brothers. And you also don't need to be a genius to interpret the meaning of the dreams. This is not a dream, perhaps like Nebuchadnezzar's dream, you remember, which needed to be interpreted. The meaning was obvious. So why has Joseph told the whole family? Now, Quite a few Bible commentators excuse him for this by saying, well, he was quite young, which is true, or he was a bit brash, or he was a bit naive and didn't understand the effect he would have. Although you do notice, though, his father rebukes him. And unfortunately, you don't need to be a genius to suspect that Jacob's real reason for telling his dream is that they make him look good and elevate him above everyone else. And so he wants them to know all about it. Now, don't misunderstand, as we're going to find out later, Joseph has many, many fine qualities. But you know, Joseph thinks that Joseph has many, many fine qualities. But at that particular moment, humility is not one of them. Well, if the telling of the dreams was supposed to impress his brothers, it has had the opposite effect. On the contrary, his brothers hate him even more. And one day they concoct a scheme to kill him. But they're then persuaded, this is a bit brutal, let's merely sell him as a slave to some passing traders, which they duly do. Cover up their misdeed, they give the impression to their father that an animal must have eaten Joseph. And in support of that story, they defile Joseph's very expensive coat of many colours by dipping it in the blood of an animal. I tell you, they really hate that coat and want to see the back of it. By Genesis 39, if we can turn forward to Genesis 39, I'm not going into detail, but it's probably helpful to have it on the screen. Beginning of Genesis 39, we find Joseph is now in Egypt and he's working as a slave. But you know, God is with him even in that situation, because he's become the slave of a very prominent, powerful, and without any doubt, wealthy Egyptian called Potiphar. So while Joseph is not free, in practice, he's probably living a much better life than are most Egyptians, especially that Potiphar, who recognises that God is with Jacob. Potiphar, recognising that God is with Joseph, entrusts him to run almost all his affairs and household. But there is another crisis waiting around the corner. This is Genesis 39, verse 7. I've started with verse 7. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, it's pretty real here, come to bed with me. That's what it says here. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. Now, that's pretty good going for someone who's supposedly a slave, isn't it? I mean, he's running the show, apart from his master. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her, a very wise policy. So then, of course, we know what happens. Potiphar's wife then accuses Joseph of promiscuous advances towards her, which is, of course, the very thing she herself is guilty of. And the master believes her, and Joseph is cast into prison. So at this stage, as far as Joseph is concerned, resisting temptation has been rewarded with false accusation and imprisonment, and he's now back to square one. Okay, we're now in Genesis 39, verse 20. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison. But you notice what kind of prison it is. The place where the king's prisoners were confined. And while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him, the Lord is still with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favour in the eyes of the prison warden. Now, living in a prison is no doubt not as luxurious as living in Potiphar's household. It's going to be a much harder life. But again, God is with Joseph, even in his hardships, because this is the place where the king's prisoners are kept. This is not any old ordinary prison. Now, it certainly wasn't five-star accommodation, but it could have been much, much worse than that. Okay, verse 22. So the warder put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warder paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Okay? Joseph then gets an opportunity, having had dreams himself, he then gets an opportunity to interpret the dreams of others. And these are two of Pharaoh's prisoners. They're servants of Pharaoh, one of whom is his baker, and the other one his cupbearer, who have fallen from favour and been put in prison. Now this puts them at very serious risk of much more drastic punishment. I would speculate, but I think it's a reasonable speculation, that the likely reason that they're there, there has been in Pharaoh's court a very bad case of food poisoning, possibly even lethal, caused by somebody's negligence. You hear about such cases even today. I mean, only yesterday I read about a case in a couple of northern hospitals, you remember? Possibly infected sandwiches. I mean, it's just the way things are. If you don't treat food carefully, things can go wrong. And like as happens today, Pharaoh himself has launched an investigation to find out and punish whoever the culprit was. And how Joseph interprets the dreams comes to pass. One of them, the baker, is hanged. The other one, the cupbearer, having been acquitted, is restored to favour. In spite of Joseph's plea to him to mention his name to Pharaoh, Joseph remains in prison. Okay, we're now up to Genesis 41, beginning in verse 1. Genesis 41, beginning in verse 1. When 2 full years had passed, that's 2 years after the incident with the cupbearer and the baker, when 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile, when out of the river there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, gaunt means very thin, came up from the Nile and stood behind those on the river bank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. And after them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy full heads. And then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. In the morning, his mind was troubled, so he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him. So Pharaoh's dreams are more like a nightmare. I mean, it depicts bad things happening to Egypt. No wonder Pharaoh is troubled. All of a sudden, and belatedly, the cupbearer remembers Joseph and his successful interpretation of his dream, the dream of the baker, a couple of years previously now. And the cupbearer tells Pharaoh about this, and Joseph is called into Pharaoh's presence. And you know, giving the credit to God, not to himself, Joseph explains to Pharaoh that his dreams warn of 7 years of severe famine that will follow 7 years of great plenty. But Joseph does more than that, because he adds his own advice onto how to meet the crisis. That's between, I think, verses 14 and about verse 40. Now, I suppose it's not a surprise he should do that. You tend to get more than you bargain for with Joseph. But he has, by now, gained a lot of managerial experience, both in Potiphar's household and in prison. And he has been used to running things, dealing with problems, and finding solutions to them. And of course, Pharaoh is duly impressed. Yes, he explains basically that during the times of plenty, you should lay up for the time of famine. Not, as I'm afraid governments tend to do these days, is to spend all the money they get during the times of plenty, and then when the recession comes, discover they haven't got any money left. So this is a very prudent solution. So in verse 37, the plan, Joseph's plan, seems good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. Verse 38, so Pharaoh asked them, and this is a very interesting verse, can we find anyone like this man in whom is the Spirit of God? Here we are. Now I'm struck by a couple of things in verse 38. Firstly, Pharaoh's use of the word we. Can we find anyone? He addresses his officials as though they're more or less on the same level as him. It is very unusual for a pagan ruler. And secondly, that he acknowledges God and recognises the presence of God's Spirit in Joseph. I think in the overall context, it is a very unusual Pharaoh. This is not your average Pharaoh facing an unusual situation. There's something special about this guy. Who knows? Maybe God's Spirit is influencing him in some way. It's certainly giving him some unusual discernment. Now, of course, let's be realistic. He is a Pharaoh. And earlier, of course, he did execute the baker. But perhaps some deaths were caused. Who knows? So Joseph is now given a job to do, which he had better do properly, I think. Verse 39, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and as wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. And it's exactly the self-same situation that's happened with Potiphar, with the warden of the prison, and now with Pharaoh. They put Joseph in charge of everything, subject only to their ultimate authority. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. The significance of the signet ring is probably had it enabled you to seal, you know, you have a wax seal. And you didn't sign these days, you have a liquid wax seal. With your signet ring, you impress your seal. That's the purpose of the signet ring. It's not just for ornamentation, it's like a functional purpose. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him made him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, make way. Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all Egypt. So what has happened? Joseph has gone from a prison to a palace, and all in the space of a single day. His dream has become a reality. I think there are two very important lessons you can draw from that. Firstly, it shows us that we never know when or how God will turn a situation around. And personally, one lesson I've learned in life is not to overreact to difficult, immediate circumstances. You never know what blessings might be just around the corner. And secondly, faithfulness in small things is the best preparation for greater things. Faithfulness in small things is the best preparation for greater things. And we will all be given responsibility for greater things. They may or may not be in this life, although sometimes they are, but even if they're not in this life, they will absolutely, certainly be in the life to come. Okay, verse 45 now. Pharaoh came Joseph the name, God of Malchor. Have you got it there? Yes, well, my pronunciation is copyright. Zaphanath Paniah, and gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. Anyway, you get the message. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So he so far spent 13 years in Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and travelled throughout Egypt. Pharaoh has granted Joseph wide powers to supervise the storage and distribution of grain in preparation for the coming famine. And given that Egypt is fundamentally an agricultural society, Joseph is more or less, and I think there are other aspects, this is just summarising, not telling us the details of, I think it's pretty clear that fundamentally Joseph is running the entire Egyptian economy. Now, don't take this too seriously. I was about to insert a joke or true, but two things occurred to me. Britain right now perhaps could do with someone rather like Joseph to sort out Brexit. Our current rulers don't seem to be doing a very good job. Secondly, I also hope that no one here has recently had any dreams about seven thin cows or seven thin stalks of grain. And if you have, can you please keep them to yourself? We don't want to know. Okay, come on. That's the joke. That's the day's joke. Okay, so 55, Genesis 41 verse 55. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. And if Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, go to Joseph and do what he tells you. Verse 57, this is a really interesting verse. And all countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the world. Now, you notice that under Joseph's direction, grain is being sold to foreigners from other countries, as well as to the Egyptians themselves. I don't think this is something that most pagan rulers would have done under such circumstances. For them, it would likely have been a case of Egypt first. Ever heard that one before? Okay, this is 4,000 years ago, so any connection to anything you may have heard today is purely coincidental. It was the case of Egypt first and Egypt only. Let's get real. That would have been the case. You can see Joseph's influence here. Okay, we've got up to 42. The answer is 42. I find chapter 42 a very difficult chapter to discuss in a sermon. Because, you know, it not only involves describing the facts, it also requires you to interpret those facts. Of necessity, I'm going to have to give you my own personal interpretation of Genesis chapter 42, which you may or may not entirely agree with. But hear me out. Genesis 42, verse 1. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other? I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us, that we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin. He was the youngest. Joseph's brother, his only other full brother, with the others, because he was afraid that some harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who also went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Verse 6. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain towards the people. When Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." Now, Joseph here is beginning to play some games with his brothers. The Bible is recording it. We mustn't make the mistake of assuming that the Bible is necessarily endorsing it. It's describing what is happening. "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest, that's Benjamin, is now with our father, and one is no more." And Joseph sees an opportunity here and pounces. Verse 14, Joseph said to them, "This is just as I told you, you are spies, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here." That's Benjamin. He knows it's Benjamin. They don't know he knows. "Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison, so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. Then if you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. So he chucks them in prison for 3 days. So his opening gambit is to say they'll all be put in prison except one of them until that one person returns with the youngest brother, Benjamin, which is essentially sentencing them, all nine of them, to at least, I guess, the spell of about a month in prison, which I think is about the time it would have taken to do the two-way journey, so from Egypt to Canaan, from Canaan back to Egypt. But to start with, Joseph puts them all in prison for 3 days while they consider his generous offer. Now let me ask a rather awkward question. What do we think? Has Joseph, at this particular moment in time, completely forgiven his brothers for what they did to him all those years ago? Personally, I would say no chance. Yes, his brothers have some repenting to do, but so does Joseph. Okay, well, this is now 42 verse 18. This is 42 verse 18. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison." One of your brothers now, he's saying, one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die. So after reflecting for a few days, Joseph has decided to be a bit more merciful. Instead of imprisoning nine of them, he's only going to enter in prison one of them and send the nine back. But of course the brothers are really shaken by this experience. They're really shaken by this experience. They're shaken by the experience of prison. They start blaming themselves and each other for their predicament, and of course a bit of guilt is now setting in now because they remember what they did to Joseph all those years ago, and they don't know that Joseph can understand them. Verse 24, "And he turned away from them and began to weep. But then he turned back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes." Now, verse 24 suggests to me there is some kind of battle taking place in Joseph's mind. A desire to punish is battling it out with a desire to forgive. And I don't think this battle has yet reached its final conclusion. And when it comes to punishment, I don't think the choice of Simeon is a coincidence. Because we know from elsewhere that Simeon had an anger problem, and together with another brother, he actually killed all the men of a city back in the land of Canaan when their sister Dinah had been raped. And of course the brother's original plan regarding Joseph, before it got changed, was to kill him too. That was the opening gambit, let's kill him. And frankly, there are no prizes for guessing which of them had shouted loudest in support of that particular idea. So Simeon's in prison for a reason. But we're now up to 25. Yes, 25. Now, for some reason or other, I switched from the NIV to the New King James. I'm not sure why. There must have been a reason. If you use the New King James from now on, from verse 25 onwards to the end of the sermon. "Then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and gave them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. So they loaded their donkeys with grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money. There it was in the mouth of the sack." This is the money they paid out for the grain. "So he said to his brothers, 'My money's been restored, and there it is in my sack.' Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying, 'What is this that God has done to us?' This appears to be a case of theft." Okay, then, but they're now on their way in Cana, and in chapter 43, which we're not going to turn to specifically, but to summarise, in chapter 43, they're now back in Cana, and Jacob, in the end, is very reluctantly, and with considerable delay, persuaded to part with Benjamin. And all the brothers, including Benjamin, return to Egypt. But by now, some months have gone by. I don't know how long this is, 2 or 3 months perhaps. All of which time Simeon would have spent in prison, wondering, no doubt, whether his brothers would ever return and he would ever be released. Okay, but they arrive back in Egypt. And Joseph receives them graciously and with great ceremony. But when they leave to return to Cana again, I'm sorry, this is quite a complicated story. It's a bit like a soap opera or some Hollywood epic. And it can't be abbreviated. I'm sorry about that. Joseph plays another game. This is now Genesis 44, verse 1. Can we get to Genesis 44, verse 1? Right. He commands the steward of his house, saying, "Fill the men's sack with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest," that's Benjamin, "and his grain money." And so he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, though they hadn't got very far away yet, Joseph said to his steward, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is this not the one," this is the cup, "from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing." Now let's get real here. I'm sorry this is disconcerting. We must get real about Joseph here. He's effectively commanded his steward to plant false evidence, then lie about it afterwards. And he's also instructed him to claim that Joseph, who's previously said he fears God, is in fact a pagan who uses his cup to practice divination. In other words, seek the guidance of the pagan gods. Now, this whole scheme is utterly bizarre. And it's also something that Joseph is completely responsible for. Personally, I can't think of any excuse you can make on his behalf. You know, being called by God for a special purpose does not entitle anyone to behave in any way they like, good or bad, with God's full blessing. But you know, God, as he often does, is quite capable of dealing with whatever schemes human beings come up with and turning them and making them serve his overall purposes. Okay? The steward then goes in pursuit of the brothers and carried out Joseph's command when he overtakes them. This is now this is Genesis 44, verse 9. He says, "With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die." Sorry, they say, this is getting a bit complicated, I'm sorry, I'm abbreviating a bit. "They say to him," they deny doing anything wrong, "With whoever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we will be my Lord's slaves." And he said, that's the steward, "Now let it be according to your words. He with whom it," the cup, "is found, shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless." Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. So he searched. He began with the eldest, and left off with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Remember what's been said? Whoever we find this sack, we find this cup in, is going to be the slave of Pharaoh. This is the nightmare scenario for the brothers. I mean, this is utterly a nightmare. Then they tore their clothes. I feel sorry for them. And each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house. And he was still there. And they fell down before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Did you know that such a man and I can certainly practice divination?" Again, he's still putting across the story that he uses his cup to seek the pagan gods. And Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? How shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup is found." But Joseph said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go in peace to your father." So what he basically says, Benjamin's going to be my slave. The rest of you can go back to your father, Jacob. Now then, Judah, we're near the end now. Judah takes the initiative. He's not the firstborn. The person who should be saying all this is Reuben, who's the actual firstborn son. Judah explains the circumstances behind the brother's visit to Egypt, and that if Benjamin the youngest does not return back to Cana to his father, he thinks it will kill his father, Jacob. And he offers himself to substitute for Benjamin. And I think finally it's the mention of the risk to his father Jacob, who he has not seen for many, many years, that puts an end to Joseph James. He can't sustain this any longer. And I think this is the moment, this is the actual moment, when Joseph finally and completely forgives his brothers and lets go of the past. That's the essence of forgiveness, isn't it? Letting go of the past. Genesis 45 verse 1. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from before me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. It's a pretty private moment, I think, really only for the family. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. I mean, he was weeping so loudly that they could hear him doing it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph, does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. I would say they gobsmacked, basically. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near, and he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." And you know, that comment in verse 5, where is it? Yeah, it's worth highlighting that. That is true as far as it goes. But you know, God has not merely sent Joseph and his brothers to Egypt to change their circumstances. He sent them to Egypt to change them. This is no longer the Joseph who was the conceited, know-it-all teenager of all those years ago. This is no longer the angry and envious brothers who hated being in second place. Everyone has learned from their experiences, painful though they were, and have become better people as a result. Okay, we're near the end now. In the book of Genesis, time moves on, and there are still some events in the life of Joseph and his family to come. But I think it's now time to wind up this particular sermon. So let's conclude. Joseph is one of the heroes of the Bible whose life had a big positive influence on others. And his dreams did eventually come to pass. But his life also contained more than its fair share of trouble and challenges. And how often do we read about that in the Bible? But it also revealed perhaps one or two things about him that we as Christians today might find a bit disconcerting. But you know, those things themselves ought to encourage us. Because the story of Joseph's life testifies to the fact that God does not need us to be completely perfect in order to fulfill his ultimate purpose for us. Even when we sin or in some way get things wrong, we can take comfort from the fact that God can take even our mistakes and shortcomings and use them for good. And we should all take comfort from that.